I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, President Biden defended his plan to bring U.S. troops and civilian personnel home from Afghanistan amid scenes of chaos and desperation at the Kabul airport, ending America's longest war.
We spent over $1 trillion. We trained and equipped an Afghan military force of some 300,000 strong, incredibly well equipped. We gave them every tool they could need. We gave them every chance to determine their own future. What we could not provide them was the will to fight for that future. But if Afghanistan is unable to mount any real resistance to the Taliban now, there is no chance that 1 year, 1 more year, 5 more years, or 20 more years, the U.S. military boots in the ground would have made any difference.
The Taliban, whom American forces drove from Afghanistan nearly 20 years ago, are back, having taken control of the country in short order. Many Afghans fear a return to their repressive and violent control of the country, especially for women and girls, and become a training ground once again for terrorists. Our guest, Carter Malkasian, has talked with the Taliban, served as civilian advisor in Afghanistan, was senior advisor to General Joseph Dunford, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 2015 to 2019, author of a new book called The American War in Afghanistan, A History. Carter Malkasian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. How would you describe today's Taliban? Can we compare it to the Taliban of 20 years ago?
They can be compared to that. Some of the things are the same, but some of the things are different. I mean, the Taliban have been striving to portray themselves as more professional, as not as oppressive and not as brutal. And we've seen some indications of that. In the areas the Taliban control, there are schools open, are some girls' schools open. We have seen some executions and examples of brutality. We haven't seen that systematically. So that's encouraging. On the other hand, the Taliban do still have certain biases and beliefs regarding how women should be treated, regarding how the country should be run, that is going to strike us as fairly familiar or fairly similar to the 1990s.
So we are just a couple of days in, so obviously it's hard to predict what is in the future. So can we say this is propaganda, or do we not know? I know there have been negotiations in Doha, and the words from the negotiators seem to send a message that we are a different kind of Taliban. I guess the question is, how much can they be believed?
They're somewhat different, but we just need to understand that Taliban have certain beliefs that are unlikely to change greatly. They're uncomfortable with women having full freedoms to the degree to which they had under the Ghani government. Taliban have often said to me that, look, how we treat women is actually protecting them by keeping in the homes, by making them be covered, by not having them have jobs. We're protecting them. It is you in the West who endanger women. And they're so emphatic about this that I think that we will continue to see those kind of restrictions in place. There's also, of course, the relationship with al-Qaeda and terrorists. I think the Taliban fully understand that their relationship with those groups caused them great difficulties in 2001. But at the same time, those relationships, those friendships, 20-plus years of fighting together, those are not going away. The Taliban aren't going to let terrorists, I think, aren't going to encourage them to attack other countries. Whether they're proactive to stop them is a different question.
Well, let's talk about how the Taliban, my understanding, about 75,000 strong, were able to defeat the Afghan military so handily. Military trained and supported by the United States and some of our allies. More than $80 billion of American dollars invested in this Afghan military. Why were they not able to fight off the Taliban?
Well, it's a combination of reasons. And I guess I would say that we're not really sure of what the exact Taliban numbers were. In 2018 or 2019, the estimates were like 60,000 to 80,000. By the time we saw what happened over the past 2 weeks, their numbers were probably far greater than that. Because as they gained success, they were gaining more supporters and more people were coming to their ranks. And that's in addition to more Pashtuns coming out of Pakistan to assist them. A flood was occurring, and that was giving them more strength. But that's probably not the most important thing here. When we talk about why we were unable to enable this military to succeed, the first thing we need to remember is that Afghanistan was – the Afghan military, the Afghan government were allied to us, and we were effectively occupiers. And whereas the Taliban can talk about fighting occupation, talk about resistance in a very historical manner, in a very way that's close to Afghan identity. And it shouldn't be hard for us to understand because it's very close to many, many countries' identity. So that means it was easier for the Taliban to inspire their people to fight, harder for the government to inspire their people to fight. And that was something that we were probably never going to overcome and is a fundamental reason as to why the Taliban tended to perform better on the battlefield than the Afghan forces. Now, in the past 2 weeks, we have to add in some additional things. The first is the shock of U.S. withdrawal. Now, that doesn't mean the withdrawal was wrong, but it does mean that when we left and there was less air support and they're now fearing fighting without us, that's going to affect a force's morale. That's going to make them more scared. So that weakens things. And on top of that, as defeats happen, morale gets worse. As forces see their brothers and their colleagues being defeated in other provinces, they fear the same is going to happen to them. And it becomes like a stock market crash. The fear of defeat means it's better to run right now than to keep on fighting hard. And so then what occurs is the rout, the total collapse that we saw happen. And this isn't unfamiliar in Afghan history, nor is it unfamiliar in military history. There are plenty of times when countries suffer a defeat that shouldn't result in total collapse, but in fact does result in total collapse.
You talked to a number of Taliban, and they all said a variation of this same thing. I will quote a Taliban religious leader saying, many of the police and soldiers are there only for dollars. They're paid good salaries, but they do not have the motivation to defend the government. Taliban are committed to the cause of jihad. This is the biggest single victory for them. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I do think that's a fundamental reason as to why the Taliban were fighting, and a fundamental reason as to why the government had trouble. If the government forces were often fighting for money, the question is, okay, why weren't they fighting for something bigger? Why weren't they fighting for the nation? And that's because what the nation stood for was less inspiring than what the Taliban stood for. Now, I should be careful here, too, because there's many causes for why the Afghan forces had difficulty. So to say it's purely about the Taliban's adherence to jihad and resistance to occupation is a simplification. There's other things like the corruption in the government forces, and there's other things like that they didn't have as good of cohesion as the Taliban forces had. But the complicated situation, and I guess now we're seeing how it's all played out.
But would you say it's that they believed in something? I mean, this is, of course, broadly speaking, with obvious exceptions, but there was this belief that was driving the Taliban that was stronger than what was driving the Afghan military?
Yes, I would say that. There's an anecdote of a Taliban and an Afghan commander on the battlefield shooting at each other, and they start taunting each other over their radios. And the Taliban commander says, "You're the puppets of America." And the Afghan commander replies back, "Well, you're the puppets of Pakistan." And the Taliban commander replies back, "Pakistanis are Muslims. Americans are not." And there's nothing more that's said, and that's the point.
But does that also say that this defeat and America, frankly, America's defeat in Afghanistan was then inevitable?
It's, to it, I'm sorry.
No, I appreciate it. I think believe me, we are all struggling with trying to understand what happened over 20 years. What does it mean? So go ahead, Gart.
So it is unlikely we ever would have succeeded in Afghanistan. So in that sense, yes, there's an inevitability to it. We could have stayed for a long period of time. We did stay for a long period of time. And during that time, secure U.S. interests. But once we left, it's very likely that the situation was going to go back to the way it was. I mean, unless we're talking about 30 or 40 very, very long periods of time. But what you say is basically correct. We were only going to be able to sustain things as long as we were there. And once we left, everything was likely to fall apart. And yes, that's defeat.
I mean, the future is obviously uncertain. And I guess the question is, now that it looks like the Taliban will be back in control, will be the government in Afghanistan, whether any of the successes, and I'm thinking of women and girls, any of the successes, the human rights accomplishments of the last 20 years will be retained, or does that all get wiped away? What are your thoughts?
Some of it will remain, but it's not going to be very satisfying, and it's not going to be equivalent to the cost that we paid. I guess obviously not equivalent to the cost we paid. The Taliban will probably let some girls go to school. They'll probably let some women work. And in the cities, some of the people who we worked with, many of the people who worked with, will remember the freedoms that they had and will value it. And they may not promote it publicly and openly, but it'll still remain within their communities and within their families. So that's important there. The Taliban may be forced to do some things, like at least for some time, like let there be some continued freedom of the press or let the press operate not completely controlled. There may be less restrictions on music and that sort of things. And the Taliban may not have the kind of public brutal executions they had in the past. So those are good things.
Yeah.
And that's some kind of change of Afghanistan. But that's pretty thin gruel.
Carter, we're almost out of time here, but just, you know, you serve there. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts over when I was serving there, it wasn't like there was a choice. I served there as a civilian, not someone in the military.
Right.
It was the United States was there. There was a threat to the United States. People were going over there, so it wasn't a question to me of was the policy right or wrong. It was something that was supposed to be done, and what I had kind of educated myself, or I had been educated in, so it was supposed to go over there. Now, of course, at this point, it's very hard to see the country fall apart. It's very hard to see the Afghans who you've known being in danger or having to live under a Taliban regime. So that's extremely difficult. What I don't know is looking on, say, several years from now, how this will all appear. Several years from now, it may look like it was the right decision for the United States.
Well, I appreciate you joining us, getting our conversation started. Carter Malkasian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. His book is called The American War in Afghanistan. We've got another guest waiting to join us. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Mott.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
It's Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. President Biden has made good on his promise to end America's longest war, removing U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Speaking yesterday from the White House, he both took responsibility for his decision and blamed the Afghan military and government for its inability, its unwillingness to fight the Taliban, which is now back in control of the country.
I am President of the United States of America, and the buck stops with me. I'm deeply saddened by the facts we now face, but I do not regret my decision to end America's war fighting in Afghanistan and maintain a laser focus on our counterterrorism missions there and other parts of the world. I cannot and will not ask our troops to fight on endlessly in another country's civil war. This is not in our national security interest. It is not what the American people want. It is not what our troops who have sacrificed so much over the past two decades deserve.
If Biden was hoping for an orderly exit, the rushed evacuation, the disturbing and chaotic scenes at the Kabul airport, and the uncertain fate of the Afghans who helped Americans have proved otherwise, there is concern that the Taliban will undo any gains to democratize the country and repress women and girls who had access to schools and jobs in recent years. So what was this war all about? Why was the government so unprepared for the Taliban's victories on the ground? And what does this say about America's standing in the world? Joining us is Andrew Bacevich. He's president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of a new book called After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. He served in the Vietnam War, and he joins us by Skype. Andrew Bacevich, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks very much.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, I want to make sure that you can join our conversation. This is such an important topic and an important day. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Andrew Bacevich, is this what it looks like when America loses a war?
Yeah, I guess so. I think having acknowledged that, I think it's crucially important at this stage not to allow the terrible images coming in from Kabul to completely dominate the conversation. You know, we didn't lose, your previous guest, I think, suggested this. We didn't lose this war in the last couple of weeks. We've been losing this war for 20 years. And so it's that 20-year span, I think, that deserves to get a lot more attention right now than it's getting.
Well, I do want to get to those 20 years, but I cannot get the images, frankly, out of my head about what we saw at the Kabul airport. You served in Vietnam. We know those images. When that war was over, people desperately trying to get out of that country, holding on to helicopters. And I'm just curious about when you see those images from the Kabul airport, what are your thoughts?
Well, it's funny. You know, I have no personal investment in this war. I mean, as you suggested, I served in Vietnam. My son served in Iraq. But I will confess that over the past several days, I've been unable to think about anything apart from Afghanistan, and you know, it's depressing. You feel a sense of helplessness. You feel a sense of outrage. You feel a sense of humiliation. There is no way to dress up this moment as other than the catastrophe, the debacle that it is. But again, to go back to my previous point, there's an urgent need to understand how this debacle came about. And the partisan commentary that wants to lay the entire blame on President Biden, I think is radically misplaced. I understand the way partisanship works, but I don't think we should indulge that line of argument too much.
Does the blame go to four presidents then, from Bush to Obama to Trump to Biden?
Yes, and it goes to members of both political parties. It goes to the media. I'm struck as I read the newspapers over the last few days by the reporting that basically says, "Aha, this war was always lost. This war was always a mistake." You know, somebody who regularly reads the New York Times, regularly reads the Washington Post, I don't recall that theme being emphasized. And this is a military failure. The United States military did not accomplish the assigned mission. We've had a parade of generals running the war for the last 20 years, and they own a part of this failure as much as the politicians do.
I mean, it raises all sorts of questions, and you know, the most obvious one, and I raise it with our first guest, is here, you know, you've got the world superpower, the United States of America, investing something like $80 billion into a military that, at least in the last couple of weeks, just folded in the face of the Taliban.
Well, I do think this is one of the areas where the Vietnam War comparison, bears reflection. In Vietnam, we spent years trying to convert the Army of the Republic of Vietnam into a competent fighting force. You can make the same comments about the ARVN that President Biden made about the Afghan security forces. You know, we gave them equipment. We gave them training. Certainly, by sort of any superficial measure, they should have been able to outfight the North Vietnamese. But what we could not endow on the ARVN, and what we've not been able to give to the Afghan security forces is motivation.
Hmm.
I think your previous guest was exactly on target. The people we hoped would fight and perhaps die to defend their country were not willing to do so. They didn't think their country was worth that. I think that was true in Vietnam back in 1975. It's true in Afghanistan today. So that gets to the essence, I think, of an explanation for the military failure. But again, there's more here than simply a military failure.
Well, let me ask you, and even if we roll back the clock almost 20 years, so the fall of 2001, after September 11th, the U.S. goes into Afghanistan, topples the Taliban government, and that had been a place that had harbored terrorists. I mean, with this advantage of hindsight, should we have just said, okay, we mission accomplished, and now we'll go back home?
You stated more sharply than I would. We couldn't just walk away.
Right.
But I think we could have defined a more modest set of goals. The other day I went back and looked at the results of the Bonn conference. This was a conference convened in Bonn, Germany, in December of 2001. So this is weeks after the Taliban have been overthrown. The U.S. and its the West, basically, officials get together and say, well, okay, what do we want to get done in Afghanistan? And the definition of goals is quite striking as we consider them in retrospect. I'll quote, the United States and its allies were going to bring about, quote, national reconciliation, lasting peace, stability, and respect for human rights throughout Afghanistan. The United States was going to enable the people of Afghanistan, quote, to freely determine their own political future in accordance with the principles of Islam, democracy, pluralism, and social justice. Now, let me simply say that is an ambitious agenda. Where'd that agenda come from? Well, it comes from our own sense of our own definition of universal values, but it also, I think, comes from the prevailing view in the post-Cold War period that somehow history was intended to go in some particular direction. We knew what that direction was supposed to be, and we were in a position, as the most powerful nation on the planet, we were in a position to nudge history along. And all that is a long-winded way of saying hubris, arrogance. I think those informed this undertaking from the very outset, and we set goals that we were never in a position to implement.
It's funny, as you were, not funny, funny, haha, but as you were writing, I wrote word ignorance and arrogance. I mean, do you see that as a kind of a combination of the two? I mean, those are lofty goals. I mean, who wouldn't want that? But the realities on the ground can be so different.
That's exactly right. It's hard for us, I think, to recapture that post-Cold War moment. You know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, when democracy seemed to be on the march, the expectation was high that Russia would then emerge as a liberal democracy. at a time when the growing might of China, particularly its economic development, fed into expectations that, well, as the Chinese get rich, they will inevitably embrace liberal values. So this arrogance that you referred to, it was in the air, probably particularly in the air in places like Washington, D.C. And I think that it set us off on the wrong path. You know, your earlier question, should we have just, you know, overthrown the Taliban and left? Well, it was never going to be that simple. But it didn't have to, the overthrow of the Taliban didn't have to lead us to undertake this vastly ambitious nation-building exercise in a country that simply wasn't conducive for imparting that value set.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you and read some comments that we have here. That's Andrew Basevich. He's president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of a new book entitled After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. He served in the Vietnam War. His son served in the Iraq War. We're talking about Afghanistan, of course, which is what everyone is talking about today. And you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Let me read a couple of comments, and I have some more questions for you. Ann says, what President Biden is totally oblivious to is that with the loss of Afghanistan and the Taliban, we are endangering the security of the United States. Tommy says, sad to hear Mr. Biden argue that we plan for every contingency. The final contingency, perhaps the most obvious one, was very obviously not. This is a failure of civilian and military leadership in both countries over many years. A comment from Jess Med, I support Biden's decision to pull out our troops. We got Osama bin Laden, which means our mission was accomplished. It's time for us to get out. A year would have been absolutely made no difference. Andrew Basevich, and President Biden said this yesterday, we were not there to do nation building. But I think for a lot of Afghan people, they felt like we were there to do that, especially the women and girls, women in government, women holding jobs, women going to university, girls, you know, going to schools just like little boys in Afghanistan. Do we just say, you know, sorry, never mind?
No. I believe that President Biden made the correct decision to end U.S. military involvement. And I agree with him, with his stubbornness in saying, I still think I was right, despite the, you know, obscene mess that we see unfolding. That said, that doesn't mean that the United States walks away from this. We cannot for practical reasons, we must not for moral reasons. There has been a great deal of attention, I think belated attention, to the need to evacuate from Afghanistan Afghans who have supported us and members of their family, recognizing that they may well be at the top of whatever list the Taliban has of people they want to punish. It's sad that we are scrambling at the last minute to make this happen, but the effort needs to continue. Now, then there's the broader question of Afghans who will simply not wish to live under a Taliban regime. And as you said with your previous guests, we don't know exactly how that regime is going to unfold. But it's not going to be a liberal democratic enterprise. What we're likely to see happen is a massive refugee outflow. You recall that at the time of the Soviet intervention back in 1979, I don't remember the numbers, but I believe it was in the millions of Afghans who fled primarily to Pakistan, but also to Iran, where they lived in refugee camps for a long time. Well, if something comparable happens now, and I think that's likely to happen, well, the United States needs to step up to the plate and do whatever is necessary to provide at least minimally adequate life support for Afghan refugees. We must do that. And I'm hopeful that the Biden administration will recognize that. But none of that says that somehow we could have fulfilled our initially excessive ambitions. And I do think the beginning of wisdom is to recognize that to some degree this was a star-crossed proposition from the very moment it began.
About U.S. standing in the world, have we taken a hit?
Well, sure. But I think that the commentary that says, well, nobody's ever going to trust us again, I think that that tends to be overdrawn. Why overdrawn? Well, because to some degree, our trustworthiness will be determined by our actions from this point going forward. Let me give what may be at least a partly relevant example. When the George W. Bush administration decided that it was a great idea to invade Iraq in March of 2003, we should note parenthetically that that decision all but doomed the war in Afghanistan, which thereafter got minimal attention and support. But when the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, over the objections, clearly articulated objections of key allies such as Germany and France, people said then, well, that's it. Nobody's going to want to support the United States. Not true. Because subsequent to the Iraq War, guess what? It turns out that having a collaborative relationship with the United States is in the interests of Germany, is in the interests of France. So we find ways to move beyond the catastrophes that we create along the way.
Again, that's Andrew Bacevich, our guest on Radio Times. Today we're talking about Afghanistan, President Biden's decision to get out of Afghanistan. And again, we want to hear from you, Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after the short break. This is Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Andrew Bacevich, again, president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of a new book called After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. He served in the Vietnam War. Let me ask you a couple of questions about your new book. And one of the things that you call for, rather than thinking about defunding the police, you say it's time to think about defunding the Pentagon. Expand on that idea for us.
I thank you for that question.
Sure.
And I think it relates very much to the outcome of the Afghanistan war. If we step back and think about the way that we Americans have come to think about national security, basically since the end of World War II, the threats that we worry about are out there. They are in Europe during the Cold War, for example. They are in East Asia. They're in the Persian Gulf, in the Middle East. And the response to those threats has been to arm ourselves, to build up massive military forces designed not in particular to defend the United States of America, but designed to serve as instruments to deal with threats out there. That's what we've been doing for the past 20 years in Afghanistan, what we've been doing for almost the past 20 years in Iraq. And quite frankly, many in Washington are gearing up for another war, albeit a Cold War, targeting China. But the point is, it's threats out there that we attend to. I think we're living in a moment when it's threats back here that deserve far greater attention. And those threats are... They're right in front of us. It's the threats of pandemics. It's the threats of wildfires. It's the threat of environmental degradation. It's the threat of borders that we are unable to control. So it just seems to me that there is a need for a radically different national security paradigm. Doesn't mean we ignore out there. This is not a call for isolationism. We still must be concerned about China's ambitions and China's behavior. But I think in terms of distributing resources, that we need to focus more on those threats that endanger Americans where they live. What does that mean in practical terms? We have the biggest Navy in the world. We've had the biggest Navy since World War II. It's a wonderful Navy. It's a capable Navy. I'm not in favor of scrapping the Navy. I am in favor probably of downsizing the Navy and having a bigger Coast Guard. You know, the Coast Guard plays an invaluable role in multiple ways to providing for the well-being of the American people here in the United States, here in North America. We've got the world's biggest and best Air Force and have had for decades. It's a wonderful Air Force. I'm not in favor of abolishing the Air Force. I am in favor of providing more and more capable aircraft to the United States Forest Service so that they can do a more effective job of putting out these fires that pose an immediate threat to our fellow citizens. So again, the key here is you're not going to ignore the threats out there, but let's privilege the concerns that pose a threat to our well-being where we live. That's one of the major themes of the book.
No, and I appreciate that. And I think it's a fresh way to think about both national security and the actual threats that we do face. Let me just try out an argument for you, Andrew Bacevich, which is since our occupation in Afghanistan and presence there, we haven't had a terrorist attack from foreigners. We've had domestic terrorist attacks, and maybe that really truly is the real threat. But nonetheless, the argument being, well, look, we were there for 20 years and Afghanistan didn't you know, harbor terrorists that fought and attacked the United States.
I recognize that Osama bin Laden was in Afghanistan at the time of the 9/11 attacks, and I recognize that bin Laden was the real architect, inspiration of the 9/11 attacks. I don't agree that therefore Afghanistan is the place that we need to worry about. It seems to me that terrorist attacks can be plotted from virtually anywhere. I mean, to a very considerable extent, the implementation of the 9/11 attacks occurred within our own borders. Yeah. I mean, that's where the hijackers learned how to fly airplanes here. So the notion that therefore to stay safe, we need to stay in Afghanistan forever, I don't think it washes at all. Furthermore, then we have to say, well, how is it that we have not been attacked since 9/11? And I suppose the fact that we've been fighting a 20-year war could be an answer. I would give a better answer, and that is that back in 2001, federal authorities were irresponsibly oblivious to the need to erect effective defenses. You know, I'm taking my wife to a family wedding tomorrow. We are not simply going to walk up to the gate at Logan Airlines. I mean, we have to go through security. Our luggage is going to be inspected. We're going to have to provide credentials to show that we really are who we say we are. My point is, I think that the protective measures enacted since 9/11 probably have at least as much to do with the fact that we haven't experienced another 9/11 as the fact that we've had U.S. forces in Afghanistan for the past 20 years.
Hmm. Here's a comment from Bill. Americans are uncomfortable describing any military action as a defeat. Much of what the media and the public are doing now shows people grappling with that. America has not won every war. Korea was a tie. Vietnam was a loss. And now Afghanistan is a loss, too. Do you agree, Andrew Bacevich?
I'm chuckling. It's not funny. It's not in the least funny. But yeah, I mean, our military record over the past 70 years or so is is at best mixed. Perhaps we are uncomfortable acknowledging defeat, but doing so is absolutely essential. Only if you acknowledge defeat can you learn from defeat. Only can we are we then better able to avoid its recurrence. Whether it's avoidance by being more prudent in committing U.S. forces to some place for some purpose, or whether it's redesigning U.S. forces so that they actually have the capability that's necessary to do better next time. Yeah, it's painful. It's embarrassing. But it's essential, I think.
Let me quote you from Business Insider. You write, in Afghanistan, through ignorance and arrogance, we were talking about that, compounded by an unwillingness to face facts when victory proved elusive, the world's self-proclaimed sole superpower bit off way more than it could chew. We owe it to those who served and sacrificed to openly acknowledge the causes of our failure. Only then can we guard against their repetition elsewhere. And it's hard not to think about the many Marines and soldiers and others who either fought in Afghanistan or worked there and trying to, help the people who were living there, trying to create a civil society, and what they must be thinking today. And we're going to do a show about that. But I'm, as someone who served themselves and had your son serve in Iraq, your thoughts about just the kind of service and sacrifice that people made for Afghanistan?
I think I can feel at least something of what Afghanistan veterans are feeling right now. And they have every right to those feelings. All I would say is that soldiers don't get to choose the cause. My West Point classmates who died in Vietnam, it's fair. What did they die for? I think the answer is the only even moderately satisfactory answer is they died for their country. Hmm. It was a lousy cause. It was a futile effort. They died for their country. If there is honor, that's where it is. Those who died in Iraq, a misguided war, if there ever was one, they died for their country. And those who fell in Afghanistan in this terrible moment of collapse, they died for their country. I think that's the best we can say. The best is not necessarily satisfactory, but I think that's the best we can say.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, Andrew Basevich, but your son died in Iraq.
And therefore, I have thought about this issue for a lot. And that's the best answer I can come to. My son died for his country. My son served. My son died for his country. The war, which I opposed, was an exercise in folly. It was needless. It was badly managed. At least some of those who died, maybe many of those who died, died needlessly. We can say the same thing about those who died in Afghanistan. They died serving their country. And we have to remember, it's not just those who died. There's the wounded. Those who are wounded physically, those who are wounded emotionally, psychologically. We know we have a massive problem of PTSD among this generation of veterans. We know we have a massive problem of veteran suicides. So the tragedy, and we're not talking about the tragedy suffered by the Afghan people. We should not ignore that. But the American part of that tragedy goes far beyond simply the Americans who have lost their lives in these misguided wars. They served their country. I have no doubt that the vast majority of the soldiers, Marines, airmen, so on, served their country honorably. I don't know. It's hard to...
Yeah.
hard to make sense of it.
It sure is. And I appreciate that answer. And I'm sorry for your loss, obviously, as well. And I'm just, you know, it almost sounds like an argument from you, Andrew Bacevich, of against, I'm not saying all wars, but that we too easily, too quickly go to war thinking that we're going to solve some problem.
Well, I mean, you generously referred to the fact that I'm associated with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. What are we about? What's the Quincy Institute about? It's about promoting the idea of a foreign policy based on military restraint. Not a foreign policy based on disarmament or isolationism, but of being more modest and pragmatic in our understanding of what force can do, and at the same time, putting greater emphasis on diplomacy, engagement. You know, I said a minute ago, I'd like to see a smaller Navy and a bigger Coast Guard. I'd like to see a much bigger budget for the State Department. I'd like to see a comprehensive effort to reform the State Department, not simply to make it bigger, but to make it more effective. The reliance on military power that has been a central theme of U.S. foreign policies going back to the end of the Cold War has been a mistake, and we have paid a terrible price for that mistake. So a minute ago I said we need to rethink national security priorities. Hey, we need to rethink the basis of how we engage the world.
We're almost out of time here, but I do want to ask you about the Afghanistan papers that were published a couple of years ago. Some news organizations got their hands on these papers showing that the military and probably political people were saying publicly, you know, Afghan forces are better than we thought. This was from Marine General John Allen telling Congress 2012, the Afghan National Security Forces are winning. And then quietly and behind the scenes talking about the fact that, and I'm quoting here from the New York Times, that the Afghan security forces were incompetent and unmotivated, poorly trained, corrupt, riddled with deserters and infiltrators. We know there were lies about the Iraq War. There were lies about the Vietnam War. Is that just the kind of casualty of war that we have to deal with these lies?
Well, we shouldn't accept them. I mean, what's going on here? I think what's going on here is that the elites who shape U.S. behavior, policy in the world, civilian elites, military elites, they want to control the basics of U.S. behavior. They don't trust us. They don't trust the American people to be able to understand the complexities. And so they tell lies in public and they're truthful with one another behind closed doors. It's contemptible. And I think in Afghanistan, you know, that's another example of, you know, chickens coming home to roost.
Andrew Bacevich, we have to leave it there. I so appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times and giving us a lot to think about and talk about. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks very much for having me on.
You're very welcome. And he's president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of a new book called After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. He served in the Vietnam War. His son also served in the Iraq War, died in the Iraq War as well. We began with Carter Malkasian, author of The American War in Afghanistan, A History, and he served as a civilian advisor in Afghanistan. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.